Chapter 2. From a dating point of view, what I'm about to say has some importance. And it shows you how difficult it is reading a translation. Chapter 2, verse 1. After, my translation says, after 14 years. Is that what yours says?
Yes.
Okay. Turn back to verse 18. Do you see how he says, after 3 years?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, in the Greek, that after 3 years is meta. Meta, M-E-T-A, is the word they're translating after, and that's fine. In this text, it's dia, D-I-A. It's not meta, it's dia. Once again, we're dealing with prepositions, which are very hard because they're idiomatic to pin down. So these translators, who are brilliant people, of course, have every right to translate it after 14 years. However, dia normally means through, normally. This could be translated through 14 years. In other words, in the whole 14 years, what, 14 years from when? Not sure. If it's in the 14 years between my conversion and, my suggestion is, it's the 14 years from my conversion to when I'm writing to you right now in the year, it's 34 to 48. That's the 14-year period he's talking about. And in that whole, during this whole 14 years, the only other time I went up to Jerusalem was with Barnabas. This is this second visit. So the first one we mentioned back in 18, now the second one. Okay? I went up again to Jerusalem with Barnabas, taking Titus along with me. I'm suggesting that was in the year 47. I went up in response to a revelation. Then I laid before them, brackets, I think also important brackets, though only in private meeting with the acknowledged leaders. Council of Jerusalem was not a private meeting, it was a public meeting of the whole church. I don't think it had happened by this time. So in a private meeting, he discussed the whole matter with these leaders. He discussed the gospel that I proclaim among the Gentiles in order to make sure that I was not running and hadn't run in vain. He's a humble man, Paul. He wants to check it with them and saying, look, this is what we're doing in Antioch. We're receiving them in. We're not asking them to become Jews. What do you think of this? You know, is this what... And they, you know, and he says, what happened? Even Titus, he said, who was with me, was not compelled to be circumcised, though he was a Greek. But Titus is a perfect example of a Gentile Christian, uncircumcised. Takes him with him to Jerusalem and said, look, this is the kind of thing I'm doing. What do you think of it? And they didn't demand, oh, no, you can't do that. You must circumcise the men because they've got to become Jews. They didn't do that, he says. And this is exactly, do you see, what the group in Galatia are telling the people they've got to do. He's saying, no, no, we discussed this in Jerusalem privately with the leaders. It's not commonly known, but I was there and we did have a discussion and they didn't demand that Titus be circumcised, though he was a Greek. But because of false believers... In other words, Christians who have the wrong idea of Christianity, secretly brought in, who slipped in to spy on the freedom we have in Christ Jesus. Some people don't like freedom. I'm not sure I like a lot of it myself. It's a tricky business. If you're a bird and you've been in a cage all your life and everyone comes along and feeds you these things and teaches you to say, and they feed you wheat and you've got water every morning and every night and you're cuddled and liked and sung to and clothed, everything's at night, it's perfectly comfortable. And then one day someone comes into the budgerigar and opens the thing and says, there we are, would you like to fly? And first of all you might think, oh yeah, flying will be all right. You get to the door of the cage and look out, and there's a cat about to pounce. There's a crow about to sweep down on you. Where are you going to get your food? Where are you going to get your water? Where's the wheat going to be? Don't blame me if I say, oh, well, yeah, I'd love to be free. And then go back into the cage, because the cage is golden, protected, certain, and you could spend your whole life and die peacefully, having done nothing, in a cage. Or you can take the risk of life. It's a bit of a funny thing to say, I suppose, but that's what we're talking about. The freedom that Christians had, and without freedom you can't be a saint, you can't love, you can't do anything really worthwhile, is a beautiful thing, and Paul knows it, because he knew what he was like when he was, if I could use the expression, a screwed up young man who was good, really good. But he didn't have it right, and he came to a breakdown from it. Now he's free to love, and he doesn't want to go back, and he doesn't want them to go back, so that they might enslave us. They're going to take us back to a form of slavery, says Paul. By the way, he doesn't even finish that sentence. He's so passionate in this stuff. Verse 5, we didn't submit to them even for a moment so that the truth of the gospel might remain with you. We're not going to give in to this kind of pressure, because what we've taught you, we want you to believe and hold, and we won't give up on it. And from those who were supposed to be acknowledged leaders, brackets, what they actually were makes no difference to me. God shows no partiality. Those leaders contributed nothing to me. On the contrary, when they saw that I'd been entrusted with the gospel for the uncircumcised, just as Peter had been entrusted with the gospel for the circumcised, he goes on, what happened? So he didn't give in to them. He calls them leaders. He's not knocking them. He's just saying, I don't care who's in charge. It's irrelevant to me. I mean, people can get in charge and be important. People get in charge and be baloney. People can be a pope and a saint. People can be a pope and a demon. People can be a bishop and highly intelligent, or people can be a bishop and just get in the road all the time. People can be a parish priest and preach beautifully to people, or people can be a parish priest and bottleneck everything and nothing can happen in the parish. Do you know what I mean? It's okay, let's treat them, let's love them like everybody else, but let's not get caught up in a machine that's got all this authority business. God isn't into all that, he says. So whatever, and he's not really fussed by people who say, oh, but Peter said. Well, if Peter said the truth, listen to it. If Peter doesn't say the truth, don't listen to it. I'm not, you know, that's what he's saying, I think. Just get things in order. Well, he says, yes, verse 8, for he who worked through Peter, this is what matters, he who worked through Peter, it's God doing it. He who worked through Peter, making himself an apostle to the circumcised, also worked through me in sending me to the Gentiles. That's what matters. It's the one God. Let's listen to God. Let's be in prayer. Let's be in love. Let's watch Jesus. And don't let authority become too important. Listen humbly, by all means. But check, discern all of that. I've got a lovely little bit here that I thought of this morning when I was trying to pray through this to help you. This word, God who worked through me, the Greek is energeo. We get our word energy from it directly. God, the one who energizes. And that's beautifully used also in another text of Paul. Here it's 1 Corinthians 12 verses 4 to 7 is the text I'm reading from, to spend a minute on it. And Paul says, speaking of the community in Corinth now, but he uses the same word, that's why I'm sharing with you. He says, there are varieties of gifts. Of course, we've all got charism, grace. Charis is grace. Charisma is a gift given by grace. That's not a natural quality simply. It's a grace thing. All our natural qualities are graces too, of course, because God is the God of everything. So there are many, many gifts, but there's only one spirit, only one breath breathing through us all. That's what we've got to get in touch with. There are varieties of ministries, diakonia. Ways of doing God's will. But there's only one Lord, that's the risen Christ Jesus. And there are, and here's our word, this is the noun, energeo is the verb, energema is, there are varieties of ways of exercising power, meaning enabling energy. There are varieties of them. But it's the same God who inspires them in everyone. To each is given a manifestation of the Spirit for the common good. Can you see in that an early statement of the Trinity? Varieties of gifts, there's only one Spirit though. That's you there, that's life. That's Shiva, that's the dance of life. So there's only one Spirit, whatever gift you have, we've all got the same. There's only one Lord. But we're all carrying out his mission to the world, continuing the mission of Christ, wherever we are. And this gift which enables you to carry out the mission given you by Christ is not a powerless thing. It's immensely powerful because it has all the power of God, the Father, the Creator, in it. Interestingly, as you notice in the New Testament, God invariably, there may be one or two texts that argued about, God always means the Father, the one Jesus prayed to. God, Theos, is the Creator, the Father, the one Jesus prays to. Later, perhaps in the New Testament, but certainly soon after, the word God is also used of Jesus. But originally, you see, you couldn't do that, if you understand. If you use the word God of Jesus, you could end up thinking you've got two gods, and that's not Christian faith. In fact, the Muslims still think we have three gods because of the way we talk, sounds like it. And they would find that horrible, and they do find it quite horrible. And maybe in our minds sometimes we do think as though we've got three gods, well, we haven't. So the Trinity is a very subtle, very beautiful doctrine. But if it takes away from the oneness of God, we've lost it, we've got it wrong. So the divine, in other words, for us is a communion of love. It's one because communion of love. It's not one because isolated somehow. But there's the word again. Paul is talking about the energy that comes from God. Well, Peter has it with his special charism and special gift to the Jewish community, and he has been given it, Paul, as his special gift for the Gentile community. And so we come nearly to an end. And when James and Cephas and John, who were acknowledged pillars, recognized the grace that had been given to me, they gave to Barnabas and me the right hand of fellowship. They shook hands and agreed that we should go to the Gentiles and they to the circumcised, to the Jews, in other words. They asked only one thing, that we remember the poor, which was actually what I was eager to do. And the final verses, something else happened, probably just before Paul's writing. So he's talking about an earlier visit. Now he's talking about they're back in Antioch after the travelling through the Galatia. He's come back, and one of the visitors that came there was this beautiful Peter, and this is what he says about that. When Cephas, he calls him now, by having called him Peter a moment ago, he calls him Cephas now, so he's giving the Greek transliteration of the Aramaic name, which is what they would have called him. When Cephas came to Antioch, he says, one of the Jerusalem leaders, of course, I opposed him to his face, says Paul, because he stood self-condemned. Now, we've only got Peter's, we've only got Paul's side of this, but saints can argue. You're a saint and your husband's a saint or your wife's a saint, you're both saints, but you have your arguments, thank God, because you love each other enough to struggle for the truth together. So, that, okay, I'm not just assuming you're saints, you probably are, well on the way. So, he opposed him, he said, and it's good to know this can happen. For, now, this, what had Peter been doing? Let's watch it carefully, because it's quite important for our letter. Until certain people came up from James, he used to eat with the Gentiles. Do you remember in the Acts of the Apostles, if you haven't read it for yourself, chapter 9 and 10, Peter is somewhere in Joppa and he has a vision and a blanket comes down and the vision, God says to him, eat. And Peter says, oh no, I'll never eat those things because they were forbidden food, remember? And then God says, what I declare clean cannot be called unclean, eat it. And Peter obeys in his dream. Then he wakes up. And people come from a man called Cornelius, who's a Gentile. And because of this dream, Peter's psyche, Peter was the first one to go into a Gentile's home and accept Gentiles into the Christian community as Gentiles. Eh? This is breaking new ground, Peter did. And because of that, when Peter went up to Antioch, went down to Antioch, to visit the community there and the Gentiles were there, he sat with them, welcomed them, embraced them, laughed with them, talked about Jesus with them, and ate their food, which is fair enough, exactly what he learned to do. So that's what Peter was doing. But when this group came up from Jerusalem, this fairly tight group, who were Jews and pretty proud of it, and okay, just another way of looking, Peter drew back and stopped doing it and kept himself separate for fear of the circumcision faction, that group in the early Christian community who insisted on circumcision. So Peter, now, was Peter bad to turn back? We're now into prudence. How do you work out? These are very complicated matters. Let's not take sides on it. Peter had a big job. The Jews were a troubled people at this time, particularly working our way now close towards the big war with Rome. So if Peter's trying to preach to Jews and reach out to them, can't you see that if this group come up really determined, Peter might have thought it more prudent to not be publicly doing something, because if it got back to Jerusalem secondhand that Peter was eating with Gentiles, can't you see that all Jews would then say, oh, out, we're not listening to him? So in order to reach them, I'm only guessing, Peter may have judged prudently that the behaviour he was going on with, okay, but Paul saw it as letting the whole show down. Was Paul right? Was Peter right? I don't know. We've just got Paul's story. However, the other Jews joined him in his hypocrisy. Even Barnabas was led astray. I'm starting to side with Peter, aren't you? I mean, if Barnabas did it, and the others all did it, so you can't side. Paul saw something so important, and I think what Paul saw was right, really right. Were all these people being weak, or were they being prudent? I don't know, and you don't know. We've got to be careful, haven't we, judging each other. It's a prudential judgment, and that's not easy to make. What do you do as a mother? What do you do as a priest? Do you do something and the bishop's going to take your faculties away and you'll never be able to be a priest again? Do our bishops insist on ordaining lay people, married men, in spite of what Rome has said? And if they do, will they be cut off? Do you get me? The problem, what do you do? And do you end up with having all the bishops will be people who agree with Rome after a while? That's nearly what's happening. And if that all happens, the church gets locked into a centralised system that's not vitally in touch with the people. We just run out of priests, and then a priest has to have 5 parishes instead of 2. And then we all get together and have meetings and say, no, I think a priest should have 7 parishes. And we become like a tow truck driver, and the older we get, the more work we've got to do, because there's fewer of us. That's all familiar, isn't it?
Yes.
Okay, and if you're the bishop in a place like that, and you see that something's got to happen, and you do something about it in disobedience to the system, do you see your problem? You stop being a bishop and someone else comes in who agrees with the system, and you've got to work out, is it going to be worse? Is it going to be better? What do you do? We're all doing this all the time, and if you don't, well, mums are doing it, dads are doing it, I tell you, priests are doing it every time you preach. I'm doing it now, except this is being recorded and this could be the end of me, but anyhow, the problem I'm saying is real, and you know it's real. So there they are having this argument. Paul calls it hypocrisy, and Paul's a very loving man, and in the long view, you can't say Paul's wrong, but please remember, you haven't got Peter's point of view. And when I saw, Paul says, that they were not acting consistently with the truth of the gospel, and by the way, this disagreement, do you see, there's no reason for Paul to tell them about it unless it happened and unless it's got back to them. This is one of the arguments that the people who've gone to Galatia are using. We were in Antioch, and Peter agreed with us, and Barnabas agreed with us, and he agreed with us, and he agreed with us, and Niger agreed with us, and Paul was on his own. Paul's wrong. Do you get me? So Paul says, okay, we were there, but they were wrong. They made the wrong decision, and it wasn't consistent with what they said back in Jerusalem. So we're dealing with very important issues here that are conflicting issues in the early church. Paul says they didn't act consistently with the truth of the gospel. I said to Cephas, before all of them, Paul wasn't one to mince words when it comes to love and truth, if you, though you're a Jew, live like a Gentile, and you've been doing it here for months with these people, and Peter knew he had been doing it, and you haven't been living like a Jew, how can you compel Gentiles to live like Jews? And I would imagine that the beautiful, humble Peter would have said, you're right, but God, it's tough. And that's as far as we went for today's lecture.